too, when it finally became apparent Iona wouldn't return. The ever-loquacious Annette had nattered away, answering every question we asked, though most of the information consisted of her own attitudes. It was clear she was no friend of Frankie's, and I was reasonably certain she'd told us as much as she knew. Iona, on the other hand, had clearly left the vicinity to avoid being pressed. Annette wanted to believe she was done with Frankie Miracle, but I wasn't so sure. From Highway 14, we took Highway 138 as far as the 15, then angled our way down to the eastbound 10, otherwise known as the San Bernardino Freeway. Despite Dolan's worries about his heart, there is quite literally no other way to get to Blythe. This 175-mile stretch of highway extends from the eastern edges of Los Angeles and crosses the state line into Arizona at Blythe. For close to 3 hours, Dolan kept his foot pressed to the accelerator while the road disappeared beneath us. The scenery became monotonous, the typical urban sprawl of tract housing, billboards, industrial plants, shopping malls, and railroad tracks. The highway was lined with palms, evergreens, and eucalyptus trees. We passed recreational vehicle estates, an RV country club, an RV resort and spa. This was a long stretch of land where no one intended to put down roots. We stopped once for gas in Oracopia, and I picked up a copy of the Mobile Home Gazette. 16 pages of coupons for discount dinners, cruise specials, golf lessons, custom dentures, and early bird bingo. After Palm Springs, the land flattened and the color faded from the landscape. For mile after mile, there was only sand and rock, chaparral, power lines, and passing cars. On either side of the road, at the horizon, the land rose to a fringe of foothills that confined the view. Everything was beige and gray and a pale, dusty green. California deserts consist, in the main, of pale soils, fawn, cinnamon, sepia, and pink. We passed the state prison, its presence underlined by signs that advised us not to pick up hitchhikers. The speed limit was 70, but the landscape was so vast that we scarcely seemed to move. Aside from the Salton Sea to the south of us, the map showed only dry lakes. I said, "How does anything manage to grow out here?" Dolan smiled. "The desert's a marvel of adaptability. California desert has one rainy season where southern Arizona has two. The rest of the year, you have drought. If you had seeds that germinated right after the rains, the young plants wouldn't survive the hard sun and heat. Lots of seeds are covered with wax that prevents them from absorbing water until a period of time has passed. Once the wax wears off, they germinate, and that's where the food chain originates. Rabbits and desert rats turn the vegetation into animal flesh, and that provides dinner for the predators. Snakes eat the rodents, and then the bobcats eat snakes."
"Very nice," I said.
"Efficient, like crime. Everybody's busy eating someone else."
He went on in this fashion, regaling me with the mating and egg-laying habits of various desert insects, including the black widow, the brown widow, and the tarantula hawk, until I sang, "I'm getting sick here!" That shut him up. At Blythe, we turned south, taking the two-lane state road that ran 12 miles to the community of Quorum, population 12,676. On the map, the town was little more than a circle. Dolan slowed as the outlying residential properties began to appear. The houses were plain and the yards were flat. We reached the central business district less than a minute later on a main street 6 lanes wide. Buildings were low, as though by hugging the ground the inhabitants could escape the penetrating desert sun. Palm trees seemed to flourish. There were numerous motels along the thoroughfare, most with wistful-sounding names like the Bayside Motor Court and the Seashell Motel. Among the commercial establishments, many seemed travel-related. Gas stations, car dealerships, tire sales, car washes, camper shells, and automotive repair. Occasionally, I'd catch sight of a locksmith or a beauty shop, but not much else. Here, as in Peaches, there were numerous boarded-up businesses. Signs with the glass punched out, leaving only the frame. Jody's Cafe, Rupert's Auto Radiator, and a furniture store were among those that had failed. Glancing to my right, I could see that even the secondary streets tended to be four lanes wide. There was clearly nothing out here but space. As we drove through town, we made a brief detour, stopping in at the Quorum Police Department and the Riverside County Sheriff's Substation, which were next door to each other on North Winter Street. I waited in the car while Dolan talked to detectives in both agencies, letting them know he was in the area and what he was working on. Technically, neither visit was required, but he didn't want to step on any toes. It was smart to lay the groundwork in case we needed local assistance later. When he got back in the car and slammed the door, he said, "Probably a waste of time, but it's worked in my favor often enough to make it worthwhile." It was close to 5:30 by then, and the afternoon temperatures were dropping rapidly. Dolan's plan was to find a motel and then cruise the town looking for a place to eat. "We can have supper and turn in early, then scout out the auto upholstery shop first thing in the morning." "Fine with me." Most of the motels seemed equivalent, matching rates posted on gaudy neon signs. We settled on the Ocean View, which boasted a pool, a heated spa, and free TV. We checked in at the desk, and I waited while Dolan gave the clerk his credit card, picking up the tab on two rooms and a key for each of us. We hopped back in the car, driving the short distance so he could park in the slot directly in front of his room. Mine turned out to be right around the corner. We agreed to a brief recess during which we'd get settled. I let myself into my room. The interior smelled like the Santa Teresa beach, which is to say, faintly of damp and less faintly of mildew. I placed my shoulder bag on the desktop and my duffel on the chair. I christened the facilities, shrugged into my windbreaker, and met Dolan at his door. Not surprisingly, his goal was to find a restaurant with a cocktail lounge attached. Failing that, he'd opt for a decent bar somewhere, after which we could eat pizza in our rooms. We stopped in the motel office, where the desk clerk recommended the Quorum Inn, two blocks down on High Street. I'd miscalculated the chill in the desert air at night. I walked with my arms crossed, hunched against the brisk wind whipping down the wide streets. The town seemed exposed, laid open to the elements, low buildings, the only hope of shelter from the desert winds. The Quorum Inn was already packed when we arrived. The late afternoon martini crowd firing up cigarettes, alternating bites of green olives with the mixed nuts on the bar. The walls were varnished pine, and the booths were upholstered in red naga hide. The freestanding tables were covered with red and white checked cloths. Most of the menu choices were either steak or beef. The side dishes were French fries, fried onion rings, and batter-fried zucchini. You could also order a foil-wrapped baked potato smothered in butter, sour cream, bacon, and or cheese. We sat at the bar for the first hour while Dolan downed three Manhattans, and I sipped at a puckery white wine that I diluted with ice. Once we retired to a table, he asked for a well-done 22-ounce sirloin, and I settled for an 8-ounce filet. By 8, we were back at the motel where we parted company for the night. I read for a while, and then slept the way you do with a tummy full of red meat and a shitload of cholesterol coursing through your veins. At breakfast, I had my usual cereal, while Dolan had bacon, eggs, pancakes, 4 cups of coffee, and 5 cigarettes. When he pulled out the 6th, I said, "Dolan, you have to quit this." He hesitated.
"What?"
"The booze and cigarettes and fatty foods. You'll trigger another heart attack, and I'll be stuck doing CPR. Haven't you read the Surgeon General's report?" He gestured impatiently.
"Ah, nuts to that stuff. My granddaddy lived to 96, and he smoked hand-rolled cigarettes from the time he was 12 until the day he died."
"Yeah, well, I'll bet he hadn't had 2 heart attacks by the time he was your age. You keep ragging on Stacy, and you're worse than he is."
"That's different."
"It is not. You want him alive, and that's exactly what I'm bugging you about."
If I'm interested in your opinion, I'll be sure to ask. I don't need a lecture from someone half my age.
I'm not half your age. How old are you?
I'm 61.
Well, I'm 36.
The point is, I can do anything I want.
Nah. I'll remind you of that next time Stacy threatens to blow his brains out. Dolan crushed out his cigarette butt in the ashtray.
I'm tired of jawing. Time to go to work.
McPhee's auto upholstery was located on Hill Street in the heart of town. We parked across from the shop and took a moment to get our bearings. The morning was filled with a flat, clean sunlight. The air felt pleasant, but I was guessing that by afternoon the heat, while dry, would feel oppressive. By the time the sun went down, it'd be as cold as it had been the night before. Behind the shop, we could see a small lot where six cars had been parked, each shrouded in an automobile cover. That part of the property was enclosed by a heavy chain-link fence topped with razor wire. The building itself was constructed of corrugated metal with three bays on one side, the doors rolled up to reveal the shop's interior. It looked like a gas station surrounded with the usual cracked asphalt. We could see two men at work. You really think the car we're after is the one CK saw?
That's what we're here to find out, he said. We know it was stolen from here.
If it was parked near the quarry, then what?
Then we'll see if we can establish a connection between the car and Jane Doe.
We got out and crossed the street to the front entrance. Under the big plate glass window, a large concrete planter sat empty, except for packed dirt. To the right of the shop, there was a lumber yard. To the left, a long-distance hauling company with a lot full of tractor rigs and detached semi-trailers. This was a commercial neighborhood made up of businesses that catered to customers in pickups and vans. The showroom was an extension of the shop area out back. The floor was done in black and white vinyl tile. Behind a glass case filled with service manuals, there was a metal desk, metal file cabinets, and a Rolodex. The top surface of the glass case was piled high with sample books showing automobile and marine vinyls. Performance-rated fabrics for heavy-duty application. Rear and side camper windows in a variety of styles had been mounted on pegboard and hung on the wall. We picked our way through a cluster of bench and bucket car seats, still exhibiting their torn upholstery. A display board was set up to show the leather vinyl match for Ford, GM, Chrysler Jeep Eagle, Honda, and Toyota interior upholstery. You could order any number of convertible tops, tonneau covers, floor mats, and glass or plastic window curtains. An open door led from the showroom into the first of the three connecting bays where one of the two men looked up. I pegged him in his mid-30s. He was medium height, clean-shaven, his complexion ruddy. His hair had the kind of blonde streaks that women pay money for. He wore it parted in the middle with strands falling loosely on either side of his face. Most of his teeth were good. There were creases around his mouth where his smile had made inroads. His hands were dirty, his nails permanently underlined with black like a lady's French-tip manicure in reverse. Blue plaid flannel shirt, jeans, desert boots. He was built like a high school football player, which is to say, some guy who'd get creamed if he played football today. I tried to decide whether I'd have been attracted to him when I was 16. He looked like the type I'd have had a crush on from a distance. Then again, most guys in high school were like that, as far as I was concerned. He was using a crescent wrench and a pair of pliers to dismantle a car seat that was propped up in front of him. The workbench, which extended the length of the wall behind him, was stacked with bolts of vinyl hoses, coffee cans, sheets of foam rubber, toolboxes, cans of latex paint, tires. Two fans were blowing, thus circulating the smell of synthetics. Beside him there was a garbage bin full of scraps. A second ripped and cracked auto seat sat on a counter nearby. He was smoking a cigarette, but he put it out casually before he spoke to us.
Help you?
Dolan put his hands in his pants pockets.
We're looking for Rule McPhee. That's my dad. He's retired. Who are you? Lieutenant Dolan, Santa Teresa Police Department. This is my colleague, Ms. Milhone. I didn't catch your name. Cornell McPhee. Are you the one who left the phone message? That's my partner, Detective Oliphant. As a matter of fact, he left 4 and says your father never called him back.
Sorry. I didn't realize it was urgent. I gave Dad the messages and he said he'd take care of it. I guess it slipped his mind.
The second man in the shop was older, possibly in his 50s. He'd returned to his work as soon as he figured out the conversation had nothing to do with him.
Your dad's still in town?
Cornell put down his crescent wrench and wiped his hands on a rag.
Sure. What's this about?
We're hoping to track down a vehicle stolen from his shop in 1969.
Cornell's brow shifted slightly.
That car was recovered. It belonged to a guy in Arizona.
Dolan smiled briefly.
We know about him. DMV says the car's now registered to Rule McPhee.
What brought this up again?
We're looking at the possibility of a link between the car and a homicide back then.
A homicide?
That's right, Dolan said. We're taking another run at it.
I'm still not clear why you want to talk to him.
We have a witness who says he saw a red Mustang in the area shortly before the body was found. We're wondering if the vehicle's the same one stolen from his shop.
You can ask him if you want. He and Mom live on Fell, 1520. It's just a few blocks away. You go down 2 blocks, take a left at Ruby. You'll find Fell 5 blocks down. You want me to call and make sure he's there?
Oh, that's fine. We can swing by later if he's out somewhere, Dolan said.
He indicated the seat Cornell was working on.
How long does it take to do a job like that?
Couple of days. Depends on the condition. You have some work you need done?
Might.
What kind of car?
Chevy, 1979.
Leather seat?
Oh, cloth.
Cornell smiled.
Throw a bedspread over it, you'd be better off.
That's my idea. I just wondered what you'd say. Appreciate your help.
Sure, no sweat. I wish you luck.
The house at 1520 Fell was a red brick ranch with detached 2-car garage on the right-hand side of the drive. Behind the house, at a distance, I caught sight of the rear of an outbuilding that looked like a large storage shed or second garage. A basketball backboard was still planted in concrete on a wide asphalt apron set aside for guest parking. Cornell probably spent his leisure time in high school practicing free throws. I imagined him lettering in 3 sports, elected pep king or treasurer of his senior class. A check of the yellow pages had indicated that McPhee's was the only game in town, so he must be doing well financially, even if his job lacked glamour and pizzazz. Dolan parked at the curb out in front, and we made our way along the walk to the porch, where we rang the bell. The door was opened by a girl who was probably 6 years old, judging by the number of missing teeth. Her hair was still a white blonde that would probably darken over time. She wore glasses with pink plastic frames and a pair of barrettes with a row of pink and blue flowers. Her dress was pink and blue plaid with rows of white smocking across the bodice. Dolan said,
"Hey there, young lady. Is your grandpa at home?"
"Just a minute."
She shut the door, and a moment later her grandmother opened it, wiping her hands on a kitchen towel. A mild, vanilla-smelling breeze wafted out from behind her. She was heavy-set and wore small, rimless glasses and a knee-length striped apron over a loose, floral-print house dress. Her gray hair had a fringe of curls around her face while the rest was cut short.
"Yes?"
"Good morning. We're looking for Rule McPhee. Cornell over at the shop gave us this address."
"Rule's out back. Won't you come in? I'm Edna, his wife."
She opened the door for us. We did a round of introductions that included the McPhee's granddaughter, Sissy, who skipped on ahead of us in her Mary Janes. Edna led us through the house, saying,
"We're about to frost cupcakes for Sissy's birthday. 6 years old today. She's having a little party with her kindergarten class this afternoon." Sissy said, "My grandma made me this dress."
Dolan said,
"Well, that's real cute. I like that."
As usual, I played the silent sidekick, prepared to fly into action if Edna or the child suddenly went berserk.
Sissy had climbed onto a kitchen chair and was now perched on her knees inspecting the baking project. On the table there were two muffin tins, each containing 12 freshly baked cupcakes in paper liners with little golden-brown domed heads. I could see the yellow cake mix box on the counter by the sink where the mixing bowl sat. The room was decorated in a patriotic flurry of red, white, and blue. The kitchen paper was done in Revolutionary War motif, a repeating pattern of battle scenes, complete with cannons, ships, and soldiers in various heroic poses. The woodwork was white, the counters red, and a window seat built into a side bay was filled with plump pillows and a neatly folded quilt, all in coordinating hues. Crayon and finger paint projects were fixed to the refrigerator with magnets shaped like fruit. There were also school pictures of two additional girls, ages about 8 and 10, who might have been Sissy's sisters. All three had the same blonde hair and features reminiscent of Cornell's. Sissy lowered her face, her nose a mere centimeter from a cupcake. Edna said, "Sissy, don't touch. You wait until they're cool, and don't pick at them. Why don't you take these nice folks to see Grandpa? I'll have the frosting ready as soon as you get back." That job would be quick. I could see the container of ready-to-use fudge frosting on the table with a photo of a shiny chocolate swirl like an ocean wave on the side. As a kid, I'd imagined that's what real grannies did, sewed and made cakes. Aunt Jen always said, "I'm not the cookie-baking type," as though that excused her from cooking of any kind. Now I wondered if that's why I was so bent, because I lacked the homely services she'd so proudly repudiated. Sissy got down off the chair and took Dolan by the hand. Behind Edna's back, he shot me a look that said, "Help!" I trailed after them, crossing a section of grass that butted up against the garages. A side door stood open, and Sissy took us that far before scampering back to her post. Rule McPhee sat on a wooden desk chair inside the door. A small color TV set had been placed on a crate and plugged into a wall-mounted outlet. He was smoking a cigarette while he watched a game show. Rule was half the size of his wife, gaunt-faced and sunken-chested with narrow, bony shoulders. He wore a broken-rimmed straw hat pushed back on his head, while his bifocals were pulled down on the bridge of his nose. He smelled a teeny-tiny bit like he hadn't changed his socks this week. Dolan handled the introductions and a quick explanation of why we were there. At the sight of Rule's cigarette, Dolan was inspired to take out one of his own. Rule was nodding, though his attention was still fixed on the television set.
"That was years ago. DMV tells us the vehicle's registered to you." "That's right. Fella from Arizona brought it over here to have the seats redone. I had it parked behind the shop. Someone must have broken in and hot-wired the ignition, because when I came to work Monday morning, it was gone. Don't know when it was taken. Saw it Friday afternoon, but that's the last I know. I reported it right off, and it wasn't but a week later someone called from the sheriff's department up north to say it had been found. This fellow, Gant, who owned the car, paid to have it towed back, but it was worthless by then. Car looked like it had been rolled, doors all messed up, front banged in. Oof. Gant was pissed as hell."
He flicked me an apologetic look for the use of the word.
"I told him to file a claim with his insurance company, but he didn't want anything more to do with it. He'd already been in a couple of fender benders, and the engine froze up once. He was convinced the car was jinxed. I offered him a fair price, but he wouldn't take a cent. He said good riddance to bad rubbish and signed it over to me."
Rule's gaze returned to the screen where contestants were pressing buttons while the prize money they'd racked up was being flashed on monitors. I couldn't answer even one of the questions they responded to with such speed. Dolan said,
"What happened to the car?" "Someone pushed it down a ravine, is what I heard." "I mean, where is it now?" "Oh, it's sitting right out back. Cornell and I intend to do the restoration as soon as we have time. I guess you met him. He's married with three girls, and Justine lays claim to any spare time he has. We'll get to it in due course."
"Justine's his wife?"
"Going on 15 years. She's difficult to get along with. Edna has more patience with the situation than I do."
"You have any idea who might have stolen the car?"
If I did, I'd have told the police back then. Joyriders is my guess. Town this size, it's what the kids do for fun. That and throw paint balloons out the back of their trucks. Not like when I was young. My dad would have pounded me bloody, and that'd have been the end of that.
You ever had a car stolen from the shop before?
Not before, and not since. I put up a fence with concertina wire, and that took care of it.
He turned his attention from the TV.
What's your interest?
Dolan's expression was bland.
We're cleaning out our files, doing follow-up on old crime reports. Most of it's administrative work. I see.
Rule stepped on his cigarette and then placed the flattened butt in a Miracle Whip jar that was nearly filled to the brim. He held the jar out to Dolan, who stepped on his cigarette and added it to the collection. Rule was saying,
I'm not allowed to smoke inside, especially when the granddaughters visit. Justine thinks it's bad for their lungs, so Edna makes me come out here. Justine can be moody if she doesn't get her way.
Why'd you hang onto the car?
Rule drew back and made a face as though Dolan were dense.
That Mustang's a classic. 1966.
Couldn't have been a classic then. The car was only 3 years old.
I told you I got the car for free, he said. Once we finish the restoration, it'll be worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $14,000. Now, I'd call that a profit, wouldn't you?
Mind if we take a look?
Help yourself. I got five of them back there. One sweet little GT coupe, silver frost with the black vinyl top torn up. Doesn't run yet, and the body needs work, but if you're interested, we could talk money and maybe make a deal.
My car's fine, thanks.
Dolan lit another cigarette as the two of us trooped through high grass to a rutted dirt lane overgrown with weeds that led to the second of Rule McPhee's garages. The entire area had been undercut by gopher tunnels, and my foot occasionally sank into a softly crumbling hole. The garage was positioned so that its backside was to us, its double doors facing a flat field beyond. We could see the faintly defined path where the lane had originally been laid out, possibly in anticipation of a second house on the property. Three additional vehicles were visible in the area immediately in front of us. We checked those cars first, lifting their respective car covers like a series of ladies' skirts. The two I peeked at were in poor shape, and I didn't think they'd ever amount to more than yard ornaments. While we made our inspection, I said, "You think someone used the vehicle to drive the body to Lompoc?"
"Hard to say. She could have been alive when she left, assuming she was ever in Coram at all. Just as likely someone stole the car and picked her up along the way."
"But what if she was killed here? Why drive the body all the way up there to dump? Seems like it'd be easier to go out in the desert and dig a hole." Dolan shrugged.
"You might want to put some distance between the body and the crime scene. It'd make sense to take off and go as far as you could. Then you'd have to find a place to pull off and unload, which is not as easy as you'd think. If the body was in the trunk much more than a day, it'd start to decompose, and then you'd have a big problem on your hands. You'd have to figure the car'd be reported stolen, which means you couldn't risk a traffic stop in case the officer became curious about what you had back there. At least Lompoc's off the main highway, and if you found an isolated spot, you'd dump her while you had the chance."
"What about the original owner? How do we know he didn't have a hand in it?"
"It's always possible," he said. "Though Gant's been dead the last 10 years. Ruptured abdominal aneurysm, according to the information I received."
When we reached the garage, Dolan tried the side door, but a combination of warping and old paint had welded it shut. We went around to the double doors in front. Both were closed, but there were no locks in the hasps. Dolan gave the one on the right a hefty yank, and the three-section door labored up, trailing spider webs and dead leaves. Sunlight washed in, setting a cloud of dust motes ablaze. The two cars inside were both covered with canvas tarps, and the space was crammed with junk. In addition to old cars, McPhee apparently saved empty cans and jars, stacks of newspapers bound with wire, wood crates, boxes, shovels, a pickaxe, a rusted tire iron, firewood, sawhorses, and lumber. The garage had also been made home to an ancient mower, automotive parts, and dilapidated metal lawn furniture. The air smelled stale and felt dry against my face. Dolan paused to extinguish his cigarette while I raised a corner of the nearest tarp. This looks a lot like the tarp the body was wrapped in.
Sure does. We'll have to ask McPhee if one was taken the same time the car was.
I looked down, catching sight of the battered right rear fender of the red Mustang. Found it. Together, we removed the car cover and folded it like a flag. To my untutored eye, the car looked as though it hadn't been touched since the day it was hauled out of the ravine back in 69. At best, the exterior had been hosed off, but dried dirt still clung to the underbelly of the car with its scraped and dented right side and its banged-in driver's door. Both sides were rumpled. A portion of tree branch was caught under the left rear fender. Something about it made my heart thump. Dolan took out a handkerchief and gingerly pressed the trunk lock. The lid swung open. Inside, the spare tire was missing from the mount. A couple of dusty cardboard boxes filled with old National Geographic magazines had been shoved into the space. Dolan removed the boxes and set them aside. The exposed matting looked clean except for two large dark smudges and two smaller ones near the back. Dolan peered closer.
I think we'd better call the sheriff's department and get the car impounded.
He crossed to the single door and tested it again. Satisfied that it was frozen shut, he said,
Wait here. I'll be back in a minute.
I stood just outside, staring at the untilled pasture with its tangle of wildflowers, while Dolan headed off toward his car. I noticed he steered a wide path around the back side of the garage, where I assumed McPhee was still sitting. I couldn't see the old man, but the occasional drift of frenetic music suggested he'd remained in his wooden chair watching TV. I returned to the Mustang and circled it, hands behind my back, peering in the windows with their cracked and broken glass. The black leather seats, while gray with dust, seemed to be in good shape. Dolan returned 6 minutes later carrying a Polaroid camera, his pant legs covered with burrs. He handed me the camera while he took out a pen and a packet of seals he'd retrieved from his car. He jotted his initials, the date, and the time on 4 seals and affixed one across each of the 2 doors, one to the hood, and the remaining seal across the trunk opening. Then he clicked off a series of Polaroid shots while he circled the car. As each photograph emerged from the slot, Dolan handed it to me. I waited for the image to appear and then wrote a title across the bottom. Dolan added his name, the date, and the time, and tucked them in an envelope he placed in his jacket pocket. I said, Does McPhee know we're doing this?
Not yet.
What now?
I'll go back to the motel and call Detective Lassiter. He can send out a deputy to secure the car until a tow truck arrives. I'll also put in a request to the Santa Teresa's Sheriff's Department to send down a flatbed as soon as possible. They can load the car at the local impound lot and tow it back.
How long will that take? Dolan checked his watch.
It's 10:30 now. They should be able to get someone here by 6 tonight. Meantime, I'll call Judge Ruiz in Santa Teresa and ask him to issue a telephonic warrant. We'll return the affidavit with the Mustang and have Stacy file the paperwork up there. I'll be back within the hour.
Chapter 14. I hadn't sat surveillance for ages, and I'd forgotten how long an hour could feel. At least the car wasn't going to move. I took off my watch and slipped it in my pocket so I wouldn't be tempted to keep peeking at the time. I settled in the shade, leaning against the garage, while I added a few notes to my index cards, and then slipped the paper back from my shoulder bag and found my place. Half a chapter later, I heard a car door slam, and when I peered around the corner, I saw Cornell getting out of a white truck. He was crossing the parking pad, heading for his parents' back door, possibly to have lunch. I was starving, and had to take my nourishment in the form of an ancient junior mint I'd tossed in the bottom of my shoulder bag. I figured the fuzz on it would supply my quota of fiber. The day had warmed up considerably, and the air smelled of wildflowers and weeds. An occasional bumblebee lumbered by, a black and yellow gumball in flight. A swarm of gnats danced in the light, and a horsefly zipped around looking for a place to land. This was entirely too much wildlife for my purposes. I'm an indoor kind of person, and I prefer my contact with nature reduced to the front of a picture postcard. I heard someone trampling through the grass. I got to my feet, dusted off my jeans, and tucked the book back in my bag. I was expecting to see Dolan. Instead, Cornell appeared, smoking a cigarette he'd cupped in the palm of his hand. He didn't seem all that happy to see me. His gaze shifted to the open garage door where the Mustang sat in plain view, its tarp removed, a seal affixed across the opening of the hood. I said, "Hi, I'm Kinsey. We met this morning." I flicked a look toward the driveway, hoping to see the deputy arriving, but no such luck. "I know who you are. What's all this?" "A sheriff's deputy should be here shortly. Lieutenant Dolan thinks this might be the vehicle used to transport our victim. He wants to have it checked."
"What's that mean?"
I put a casual shrug in my voice. "It's no big deal. He wants the evidence technicians to go over it."
"And Dad knows about this?"
"I'm assuming so," I said, lying through my teeth. "I'm not sure what the lieutenant told him. You have to ask him." Cornell frowned. He dropped his cigarette and stepped on it.
"How long's this going to take?"
"Probably no more than a couple of days." I was hoping it wouldn't occur to him we'd be removing the Mustang from the premises. Also hauling it north, where he probably wouldn't see the car again for months. I didn't want to deal with him if he raised a big stink. He hunched his shoulders. "The law allows you to just waltz in this way? You're on private property out here, same as the house. My dad owns everything as far as that fence."
I turned and followed his gesture.
"Oh, I wasn't aware of that. A lot of land," I said. "Actually, we had a chat with your father and asked to see the Mustang. He told us to help ourselves."
"I don't think he understood what you meant. He didn't mention it to me."
"Is that a problem?"
"Well, no, not at all. It just seems weird."
I looked down at the ground, snubbing the tip of my right Saucony in the dirt. "I don't know what to tell you. Maybe Lieutenant Dolan can explain it when he gets back. He asked me to secure the car until the deputy arrives. Did you need something out here?"
"I came out to see what was going on. Dad saw you head in this direction, but then you never came back. Where's Lieutenant Dolan?"
I guess he went around the other way. He probably didn't want to bug your dad while he was watching his show." I let a silence settle. I didn't want to manufacture small talk, and I wasn't interested in continuing the conversation on its present course.
"I better let Dad know. He's not gonna like it, but that's your lookout."
"Go ahead, do anything you like." Cornell backed up a step and then took off for the house. By the time he reached the driveway, a black and white unit was pulling in. When the deputy got out, he and Cornell shook hands. I watched the two men confer, joined moments later by the old man himself. He had his straw hat set square on his head, the rim shading his face. Even from a distance, I could see he'd taken on the air of a bandy rooster whose barnyard was under siege. The conversation continued with a lot of hand-waving on Rule's part. The three faces turned in my direction. Behind them, Lieutenant Dolan pulled up and parked at the curb. The three of them waited for Dolan, and then another discussion ensued, at the end of which the four of them formed a little ragtag parade and trudged toward me. Dolan introduced the deputy, whose name was Todd Chilton. He seemed to be acquainted with Rule, and I gathered their relationship predated the current meeting. Chilton was in his late 30s, with dark hair clipped short on the sides and curling slightly on top. He'd loosened his tie, and he took a moment to rebutton his collar before the two of us shook hands. Rule peered at me and then turned to Lieutenant Dolan.
"This the technician you were talking about?" "She's a private investigator. We'll tow the car to Santa Teresa and do the evidence search up there."
Rule turned and stared.
"You mean to take the car away?"
He looked from Dolan to the deputy in disbelief.
"He can't do that, can he?"
"Yes, sir."
"But I hold title to that car and it's registered in my name. He never said what he was up to, or I'd have told him to get lost."
Chilton said,
"We understand that, Mr. McPhee, and I'm sure Lieutenant Dolan appreciates the inconvenience."
"Inconvenience? My foot! That car's been sitting out there for the past 18 years. If the cops thought it was so all-fired important, they should have taken it back then."
Dolan said,
The information came in a week ago. That's the first we've heard of it, or we'd have done just that. This is private property. The car belongs to me. You can't sashay in here and walk off with what's mine. He turned to the deputy. I want him out of here.
Chilton said,
I can't help you with that. He has the right to take it. And you clear off, too. What good's that gol-dang badge of yours if you can't protect us any better than this?
Chilton's manner was beginning to shift. Where at first his tone had been conciliatory, now it was turning flat.
Excuse me, sir, but that car's considered evidence in a criminal investigation. You don't have a choice. Tex don't find anything, you get the vehicle back and there's no harm done. I'm calling my lawyer.
Lieutenant Dolan said,
Mr. McPhee, we have a legitimate search warrant. You can call anyone you want, but it won't change what's happening. No disrespect intended, but you might as well save your breath.
I'm entitled to one call.
That's only if they put you in jail, Chilton said, exasperated.
No one's proposing to arrest you. It's the car he wants. He's talking about a homicide. You interfere here, and you're only making trouble for yourself. None of us want that.
Cornell said,
Let it go, Dad. Come on. They're going to do it anyway.
Rule gave way suddenly. He took his hat off and slapped his thigh with it.
People been telling me we live in a police state, but I never thought I'd see the day. It's a damn shame when a law-abiding citizen gets treated like dirt.
He walked away from the group. Cornell glanced back with a dark look and then followed his father to the house. We heard a quick horn toot at the street and saw the local towing company with a flatbed truck idling at the curb. Chilton whistled to catch the driver's eye and then gestured him in our direction with a series of arm rolls. The driver shifted gears, pulling the truck forward. He then backed into the driveway and eased up the long dirt lane toward the garage where we were standing. Dolan and I acted as sideline supervisors while the chain was attached to the Mustang's front axle and the car was winched up the ramp. Cornell's truck was gone by then, and there was no sign of Rule. Once the Mustang was loaded, we tagged after the moving tow truck as far as the street. The driver waited while we got in Dolan's car. We followed him, keeping the Mustang in view. I said, By the way, you talked to Stace? What's he heard about his biopsy and x-rays? They must know something by now. Dolan looked at me blankly.
Completely slipped my mind. He wanted to come down here, and I was so busy trying to talk him out of it, I forgot to ask.
He's joining us?
Not if I can help it. I'd rather have him up there where he can do some good.
At the impound lot, we waited while the Mustang was unloaded and the rolling gate was locked. Dolan took care of all the paperwork, and then he returned to the car. We headed for the motel. He was whistling idly to himself, tapping out a rhythm on the steering wheel.
You seem chipper. I am. I got a good feeling about this.
How long until the forensics guys can get back to us?
Soon, I hope. Things are quiet at the moment, so Mandel said he'd ask them to get right on it.
And in the meantime, what?
Nothing. If they can connect our victim to the Mustang, we'll use her dental chart to canvass the local dentists. Teeth that bad, someone might remember her.
Can't we do that while we wait? Oh, I hate sitting around. We know someone stole the car and drove it up to Lompoc. CK spotted it near the quarry.
We still don't know for sure this is the car he saw. It could have been something similar, some guy stopping near the quarry to take a leak. Don't be so quick off the mark.
But suppose this was the car. Doesn't it seem safe to assume it was used to move the body?
Where do you get that, unless they find trace evidence?
Oh, come on, Lieutenant.
I'm serious. Even if we're right about the car, it still doesn't prove the girl was from Quorum. Killer could have picked her up and stabbed her when he was on the road.
Okay, I'll grant you that one. So what now? We just sit?
Yep.
But it could take days.
I can put you on a bus and send you home, he said mildly.
That's not what I'm getting at.
Then what?
Why don't you do the sitting while I start nosing around? He shook his head.
There's no point going off half-cocked.
How about this? I'll work with the meter off, but keep a running tab of my hours. If I manage to track her down, pay me, and if I don't, oh well. Dolan thought about it, taking up his finger tapping as he studied the street ahead.
Maybe.
Come on, Dolan. Please, please, pretty please, with sugar on it. Let me take a crack at it. I'll be good, I swear.
Begging's unbecoming. You're not the type.
He stopped tapping.
I suppose I could borrow your typewriter and catch up on the paperwork. I want to get some of this down while the details are fresh.
Good. I'm glad. Makes it a lot more fun. Once in my room again, I opened the bed table drawer and took out the pint-sized Quorum phone book, looking for the address of the public library. The Quorum branch of the Riverside County District Public Library was on High Street. According to the mini-map in the front of the directory, it was only 5 blocks away. I tucked the book into my bag, left my typewriter with Dolan, and then headed off on foot. At the library, I went straight to the reference room and pulled the city directories for 1966, 67, 68, and 69. I took the phone book from my shoulder bag and turned to the yellow pages under the heading Dentists. There were 10 listed. I checked the current names against those of dentists in practice during the years in question. 2 past dentists, Doctors Town and Nettleton, had disappeared, which I was guessing meant they had retired, died, or left the area. 4 names carried over and 6 were new. Most seemed to be generalists, judging from their full-page ads, which trumpeted crowns, dentures, fillings, periodontal work, bridges, root canals, cosmetic dentistry, and oral surgery. With my dental phobia, this was making my palms sweat. Already I favored the fellow who offered nitrous oxide dentistry while you sleep. I wouldn't be opposed to postponing my next appointment till I was dead. Of the carryovers, the 4th dentist, Dr. Gregory Spears, had listed himself twice, once under the general heading and again under the listing for orthodontists, of which there was 1, namely him. The word straightening had been added in parentheses for those who didn't know what an orthodontist did. I jotted down the 4 names and addresses, returned to the city map, and charted my route. Given the size of the town, it was no big deal to walk from the library to the first dentist on my list. Spears' office was located in a storefront on Dodson. There was no one in the waiting room. His front office girl was in her 60s, a Mrs. Gary, according to her name tag. Her desktop was orderly, and the surrounding office space was laid out with efficiency. Charts filed on the vertical. A random band of color-coded labels formed an irregular line across the flaps. A small sign in cross-stitch hung on the wall. Please pay at time services are rendered. I was sure she'd be sympathetic when she heard your front cap came off in the middle of a lady's lunch, but she probably wouldn't take any guff from you if your check should bounce. When she opened the sliding glass window that separated her office from the waiting room, I placed a copy of my PI license on the counter. Dolan had given me the file containing Jane Doe's dental chart, showing the number and location of her fillings. I placed that on the counter as well. In the background, I could hear the high-pitched squealing of a drill, a sound that was sometimes sufficient to cause me to pass out. I ran a dampened palm across the seat of my pants and said, "Hi, I'm hoping you can give me some information."
"I can certainly try."
"I'm currently working with 2 Santa Teresa homicide detectives on a Jane Doe case that's been on the books since 1969. This is a chart of her dental work. There's an off chance she lived in this area, and we're wondering if she might have been a patient of Dr. Spears. She was most likely a minor when the work was done." She glanced at the file.
"He's with a patient right now. Can you come back in half an hour?"
"It's easier if I just wait," I said. "How long have you worked for him?"
"Since he opened his practice in 1960. What did you say the patient's name was?"
"I don't know. That's the point. She was never identified. She had numerous fillings, and the forensic odontist who examined the maxilla and mandible thought the work was probably done in the 2 years before her death. It's a long shot, I know."
"I doubt we'd have a chart on someone we haven't seen in nearly 20 years.
"What happens to the old charts? Are they destroyed?"
"Usually not. They're put on inactive status and retired to dead storage. I'm not sure how far back they go. You're talking about hundreds of patients, you know."
"I'm aware of that. The charts are here in town?"
If you're suggesting a hand search, that's something you'd have to talk to Dr. Spears about. I'm not sure he'd agree to anything without a court order.
We'll only be in town for 2 days, and we were hoping to avoid delay.
Wait and see what he says. It isn't up to me.
I understand. I took a seat in the corner where I sorted through the magazines. I chose the current issue of Architectural Digest and entertained myself trying to imagine a color spread on my studio apartment, all 850 feet of it. 15 minutes later, a woman with a puffy lip emerged, pausing at the desk while she wrote out a check for services. I waited until she'd left and then set the magazine aside and returned to the counter. "Shall we try again?" Mrs. Gary went into the examining room. I could hear the murmur of voices as she explained my request. Dr. Spears came out to meet me, still wearing his white coat, wiping his hands on a paper towel he then tossed in the trash. He was gray-haired and blue-eyed, and after we shook hands, mine were left smelling like soap. While he seemed to appreciate my problem, he wasn't much help. Before I could even get through the details, he was shaking his head.
I couldn't do that without a name. Inactive charts are filed alphabetically. I've got hundreds of them. From what Mrs. Gary said, the girl was a minor, which further complicates matters. I don't see how you'd find her.
She had tons of fillings, buck teeth, and a crooked eye tooth on the left, I said.
Most of my patients have crooked teeth. I'd like to help, but what you're asking is impossible.
That's too bad. I'd hoped for more, but I can see your point.
What about the other dentists in the area back then? Can you tell me anything about Dr. Town or Dr. Nettleton? I noticed both were in practice in the late 60s.
Dr. Town died 2 years ago, but his widow might be willing to help if his records are still in her possession. Dr. Nettleton's over 90. He's reasonably sharp, but I doubt you'll get much.
He turned to Mrs. Gary.
You know the family, don't you? Where's he living these days?
With his daughter. She goes to my church.
Why don't you give Miss Milhone the information? Maybe he'll remember. It's worth a try, at any rate.
Thanks. I'd appreciate that. Mrs. Gary checked her Rolodex and made a note of the daughter's name and address. From her expression, I was guessing I'd be lucky if Dr. Nettleton could remember how to tie his own shoes. I left the office, pausing on the sidewalk out front. I consulted my map and my list, moving on to the next name. I repeated the same conversation with variations in my chats with the three remaining dentists. The response was polite but discouraging. They seemed willing to help, but all of them were busy and no one was interested in searching dead files on the off chance of finding her. Not only was I unable to supply them with a name, but I couldn't prove she'd ever lived in Quorum or that her dental work was done there. My only hope had been that the meager facts in my possession might have triggered a recollection. I did have Dr. Nettleton's address, but I was too tired by then to pursue the point. It was close to 6 by the time I walked the 10 blocks back to the motel where Dolan waited. I hated admitting I'd bombed out, but that's what I did as soon as he answered his door. He seemed unusually magnanimous.
Don't worry about it. You covered a lot of ground.
For what it's worth.
Let it go for now. Start again tomorrow. You might have better luck. Right now, it's time for drinks and dinner. Are you up for that?
Sure. But you'll have to give me a half an hour. I want to check in with Henry, and then I'm grabbing a shower. If you're going to the Quorum Inn, I'll meet you there.
Good.
My call caught Henry just as he was going out the door. I gave him a hasty summary of the trip and the lack of progress, and he was properly consoling.
By the way, you received a package from Lompoc. It was on your doorstep this morning. I brought it in.
Who's it from?
Doesn't say.
What's it look like?
About the size of a shirt box, 2 pounds, probably not a bomb. I'm holding it to my ear and it doesn't tick.
Now you've got me curious. Open it and peek.
I refuse to open your mail. I'll keep it till you get back.
If you change your mind, I'm giving you permission to see what's there, I said.
How's Maddie? She's fine. She ended up staying an extra day so she could hike Diamondback Trail. There's a hot springs up there she used to visit with her husband. She's thinking about a painting of the scene if she can find it again.
Sounds like fun. Did you go?
No, my knees wouldn't take it, so I sent her on alone. Besides, I'd agreed to do a tea for Moza, and I ended up making finger sandwiches and cookies all day.
Henry had been a commercial baker during his working life, and he was still smitten with the process. He catered the occasional luncheon or tea and worked a deal with Rosie, trading homemade breads for occasional free meals.
I liked her. She seems nice. I hate to cut this short, but I'm late as it is. When will you be home?
I'm not sure yet. I'll let you know. I hung up the phone, stripped off my clothes, and hopped in the shower, thinking, late for what? He'd been in a hurry to get off the phone, but I couldn't tell if it was me he was avoiding or the subject of Mattie. I'd hoped to find out if he was interested in her and she in him. She and Henry had been cute together, and I was feeling proprietary. I'd thought it was a good sign she'd stayed the extra day, but then the mention of her husband didn't sit well with me. I'd assumed she was a widow, but she might be divorced. In either case, she'd referred to her husband twice, so maybe she was still emotionally connected to him. Not a good sign. Chapter 15. At breakfast, drinking my second cup of coffee, I said, "I'll track down Dr. Nettleton this morning to get some closure on that." I watched Dolan eat his eggs Benedict. The yellow of the sauce was suspiciously bright, suggesting that the chef had used a packet of powdered hollandaise. He mopped up a puddle of poached egg with a fragment of buttered sweet roll.
"I thought you covered all the dentists when you were out yesterday."
I shook my head. "Didn't get to him. This guy's retired. I got his address from Dr. Spears, but haven't been there yet. Are you interested in coming?"
"Sounds like something you can handle on your own. Why don't you drop me at the sheriff's department? I asked them to go through their dead files looking for any missing persons reports that might sound like our girl. After that, I'll walk back to the motel and see if we've heard from Mandel. I talked to him late last night, and he said the guy who picked up the Mustang did a quick turnaround and headed right back. He and his wife were leaving on vacation this morning, so that worked in our favor. Mandel said the evidence tech'll get on it first thing this morning. He'll call as soon as he has anything to report. I don't hear soon, I can call him again."
"Sounds good. I'll report in after I've talked to Dr. Nettleton." At the sheriff's department, Dolan put the car in neutral and pulled on the emergency brake, then slid from the driver's seat while I emerged from my side, went around the front, and took his place at the wheel. He'd fired up a cigarette before I could get my bearings. He fished his key out of his pocket and let himself into his room. I spent a few seconds adjusting the seat and the rearview mirror, trying to get a feel for the old Chevy, which had the bulk of a tank after my snub-nosed VW. As soon as I was set, the engine conked out on me. I turned the key in the ignition and pressed the gas pedal lightly, coaxing and cajoling until the engine caught hold again. I felt like a little kid. I peered down the length of the hood, wishing I were perched on a New York City telephone book, though my feet barely touched the pedals as it was. I pulled my bag onto my lap and checked my notebook for the address I'd been given, then consulted the mini-map. The town of Quorum was roughly 25 streets wide, transected by 5 big boulevards that ran east and west. A series of smaller east-west streets further defined a grid that made navigation easy. Dr. Nettleton's daughter lived on Banner Way in a small subdivision on the northern outskirts. I released the handbrake and backed out of the space with caution, then eased the car through the lot and onto the main drag. Drive time was approximately 4 minutes. The house number I was looking for turned out to be another one-story brick ranch set among full-grown trees. The two-car garage had been incorporated into the main structure, and I was guessing it now served as guest quarters. Large tubs of pink begonias were lined up across the porch with its wide overhang. I rang the bell and waited. The door was opened by a woman in her late 40s. I'd caught her in the middle of her morning exercise, pink-faced and out of breath. In the background, I could see Jane Fonda doing leg lifts. "I'm looking for Dr. Nettleton. Are you his daughter?"
"That's right. I take it you're the private detective. Alana Gary told me you might be stopping by. Come on in."
"I'm Kinsey Milhone."
"Vonda Landsberg," she replied. "Dad's in his room down the hall, the last door on the right. If you don't mind, I'll let you find your own way. Sure, is he expecting me? Hard to say. His mind is sharp, but his memory comes and goes. He can still beat the pants off my husband at chess, but he's easily exhausted, so please don't stay long.
15 minutes, tops. Vonda returned to her exercise mat while I went down the hallway to the back bedroom. The door was ajar. I pushed it open. Dr. Nettleton was sitting in a bentwood rocker, staring out the window, which was open about 6 inches. On the sill outside, someone had scattered sunflower seeds. A squirrel was perched up on its haunches, peering in at him. The old man looked 90, frail and bent, hunched in his chair with a shawl across his knees. His face was long, and his earlobes drooped like melting candle wax. Most of his hair was gone, but what he had was pure white and clipped close to his head. Flesh-colored hearing aids filled his ear cavities like flattened wads of bubble gum. Dr. Nettleton? Roomy-eyed, he turned in my direction and cupped a hand behind one ear.
What say?
His voice was powdery and dry, as though dust had accumulated on his windpipe. May I join you?
Are you the visiting nurse?
I'm a private detective. I spotted a small wooden desk chair that I pulled close to his. I sat down. He seemed perfectly accepting of my appearance on the scene. Perhaps at his stage in life he'd given up the notion of personal boundaries and privacy. In a slightly elevated voice, I explained who I was and what I needed from him. As I talked, Dr. Nettleton kept his head tilted, his trembling right hand cupped behind his ear.
Come again?
I pulled my chair closer and went through it again, speaking louder this round. I could see the intelligence in his eyes, though I wasn't at all certain he was following me. When I finished, the ensuing silence went on so long I wondered if he'd caught any of what I'd said. The squirrel picked up a sunflower seed and nibbled rapidly, cracking the shell, tail twitching. Dr. Nettleton smiled with such sweetness I nearly wept. Dr. Nettleton? He turned his head.
Yes?
I was wondering about the girl. Did you ever have a patient like her? He pulled himself upright, staring at a spill of sunlight on the floor.
The last year I had my practice, there was one girl fits that description. I was forced to retire when I was 75. Hands weren't steady, and I couldn't take standing on my feet all day. I forget her name now, but I remember the fuss I made when I saw her teeth. Told her, cavities like that can undermine your health.
I blinked at him. Maybe he'd misunderstood. She had the buck teeth I mentioned?
Oh, yes. Occlusion was pronounced, and her upper left cuspid was pointed anteriorly and slightly outward. That's this one right here,
he said, pointing to his eye tooth.
Left third molar hadn't yet erupted, and I warned her she might have a problem with it if it didn't come through shortly. She had considerable plaque, of course, and her gums tended to bleed. Teeth spoiled her looks. Pleasant-looking girl otherwise, though if I remember rightly, she had behavioral problems.
Like what?
Not sure. Something off about her. She'd been taken from her natural parents and placed in foster care. Must have had their hands full with her. Boisterous. Inappropriate. I believe she had a tendency to take things that weren't hers. She'd come in for an appointment, and the next thing we knew, the stapler'd be missing or the paperclip dispenser. I took care of her fillings and then referred her to Dr. Spears for orthodontic evaluation. Don't know what happened to her after that. Doubt she had the work done. Didn't seem the type. Pity, if you ask me.
Can you remember the name of the foster family? His focus shifted to the wall.
Not offhand. They weren't patients of mine. I forget now who they went to.
What about the girl? Do you remember her name, first, last, anything that might help? He gave his head a shake like a horse irritated by a fly.
I had to sedate her to get the work done, and that affected her badly. Sometimes happens. Made her wild. I did one quadrant at a time, but she fought me every step. Novocaine didn't seem to take either. I must have stuck her 4 times for every tooth I filled.
I wiped my damp palm casually against my jeans, my dental phobia and my needle phobia having collided midair.
Did she attend the local high school?
Must have. State law. Pretty girl, I'd say, until she opened her mouth. Bad teeth spoil your looks, and I told her so. Uncooperative. Missed 2 appointments, and she came late for the one she made. My hygienist could have told you the name, but she died. Can't believe I outlived her. Fit as a fiddle. Worked for me 32 years and never took a sick day.
What did she die of? I said, sidetracked.
Heart. Weeding a pansy bed and toppled over sideways. She was out like a light. Yard work'll do that. Wretched way to spend time. I prefer indoors. Always have.
Anything else about the girl? He squinted at me, shifting in his chair.
Why, what's that?
I said, anything else about the girl?
He studied his hands, which seemed to move of their own accord, plucking at the shawl.
I remember the foster mother raised a fuss about the bill. Sent to her in error, a simple clerical mistake. Oh, you should have heard her carry on. Had my office girl in tears. I never liked the woman after that. She'd bring the girl in, but I wouldn't go out to greet her like I did everyone else. Figured she could sit there by herself. My hygienist was the one who said the woman drank. Can't understand how social services considered her fit. She wasn't, in my opinion. But then they never asked me what I thought.
He was silent for a moment.
That's all.
I touched his arm. Thanks so much. This has been a big help. I'll leave my phone number with your daughter. You can have her call me if you think of anything else.
His wandering gaze met mine.
You play chess?
I don't, but I hear you're good at it.
I should be. My pa taught me when I was 7, and now I'm 93 years old. Son-in-law plays badly, hasn't got the head for it, if you know what I mean. Requires you to think. You have to plan in advance, maybe 10 to 15 moves. I'd be happy to teach you if you have a desire to learn.
I'm afraid not, but thanks.
All right.
He was silent briefly, and then pointed a dancing index finger at a jar on the chest of drawers.
You might fetch a few more sunflower seeds for that squirrel. Good company for me. More personality than some for the amused.
I sprinkled a handful of seeds on the ledge. Dr. Nettleton was already sinking, the energy fading from his face. As I opened the door, he said,
Don't remember your name, but I thank you for the visit. I enjoyed the conversation and hope you did too.
Believe me, I did. I wanted to put him in the car and take him with me. I waved from the door, but I don't think he caught the gesture.
I headed back to the motel. Surely we were on the right track. While Dr. Nettleton couldn't supply the name, the details he'd given me were consistent with what we knew. A thought struck me, a quick stop I could make before I reconnected with Dolan. I slowed the car and then pulled over to the curb. I picked up my map and looked for a small black square with a tiny flag on top. I did a U-turn on Chesapeake and drove back in the